May I invite Professor M.S. Swaminathan, Chairman of the Swaminathan Foundation, our keynote speaker today, to give a keynote address to the participants of the conference.
Honorable Mr. Thamarat Wangli, advisor to the minister, Madam Dr. Sonyung Piyum Sobun, the Director General of Fisheries, Honorable Mr. Kilis Niguwama from Namibia, Dr. Hiroyuki Konuma, ADG FAO here, Dr. Sena De Silva, DG, very dynamic DG of NACA, Dr. Gia Jameson from FAO, World Food Prize laureate, Dr. Gupta, and many other very distinguished scientists, fishery scientists, aquaculturists, ladies and gentlemen. I am very grateful to the organizers for asking me to share some thought at the beginning of this very important technical conference, because I am not personally an aquaculturist. About 40 years ago, I was introduced to aquaculture by two very eminent colleagues. One was Dr. Kasim, Zabur Kasim, who was then the Director General of the Central Fisheries, Director of the Central Marine Fisheries Research Institute in Cochin. The other was Dr. Jingran, the late Dr. Jingran, very dynamic director of the Central Inland Fisheries Research Institute in Barrackpore. In fact, it was Dr. Jingran who prompted me to get a center established in Bhubaneswar on inland fisheries research aquaculture. That was the learning, but they got me so excited in this area right from the beginning, so that I have found that aquaculture and agriculture, the two sides of a coin, both have to coexist and they should make both progress. You will be happy to learn that more recently there's a great sort of global shift in the concept of food security. Food security, in the past, the Commission on Food Security of FAO was established in 1974. From that time onwards, food security had largely meant the availability of wheat, rice, corn, the major cereals in the world. One examine food security from the point of view of protein energy undernutrition or protein energy malnutrition. But more recently, it is clear that we have to shift our concept from food security, to nutrition security. In other words, not only the macronutrients, but also micronutrients like zinc, iodine, iron, particularly vitamin A, vitamin B12, and so on. It is in this context increasingly both animal husbandry, fisheries, and horticulture, I must say horticulture also, fruits and vegetables, they are getting much more important. Some of you who are from FAO or connected with FAO know, more recently there has been what they call a reformed committee on world food security. It existed for a long time. The reformed committee is based upon the present UN concept of deliver as one. You may have number of organizations, but you deliver as one. For example, in the Committee on Food Security, the new Committee on Food Security, it has EFAD, International Fund for Agriculture Development, the World Food Program, and FAO and other UN organizations connected with nutrition security. This is a very important development that all the UN is acting as, just as recently the Director General of UN, Ban Ki-moon, the Secretary General of UN, Ban Ki-moon, has nominated Madam Michelle Bachelet, former President of Chile, as overall charge of all women's program. He has coordinated all programs connected with gender into one head, and no one is better than Madam Michelle Bachelet, who will be heading this women's organization. I'm mentioning it because in terms of organization, whether it's aquaculture, agriculture, more and more we'll have convergence and synergy. Among disciplines, among all aspects, you have to go from one end to the other. I will come to it later. And the other interesting thing, as a result of this change in attitude from food security to nutrition security, a committee which I now chair, what they call a steering committee for this whole committee on food security, has an eminent fishery scientist also as a member. It's a 15-member committee. One of them is Dr. Niracha Wangchinda, who is from Thailand. She is not here. I asked her whether she's going to be here. She is not here because she has some other important meeting. but an expert on food safety and trade. It's very important in terms of. So you will all be heartened to hear that today aquaculture or fisheries is not one other item, but it is considered to be part of an integrated nutrition security system in the world, which is important, both micronutrients, macronutrients, and of course clean drinking water. I am going to, first of all, I want to acknowledge in the lecture several of my colleagues from the ICR. I have not connected just now, but formally, my organization, Dr. Ayyappan, we are very happy for the first time. A fishery scientist has become the Director General of the Indian Council of Agricultural Research. That again is a recognition of the importance of fisheries. Then Dr. Ponnaiah, many others were here. And also a friend from FAO, Dr. Yeha, very kind of you to have made available a lot of data. The first slide here shows the point which I've been making, namely we have to look at food security in its totality, availability of food, which is a function of production, whether it is aquaculture, fisheries product, or animal husbandry product, because demand and supply ultimately will determine the price. Price inflation, the food inflation, will be decided by demand and supply. You need access to food, which is a function of purchasing power or of jobs or income. Today, according to FAO and others, now there is a UN Millennium Development Goal Summit happening in New York. And even this morning when I opened the television, they only showed that many countries are not achieving even the very modest goal. Reducing hunger and poverty by half in 15 years. Even that many countries are not achieving for whatever reason is. So access to food is an important part. As soon as the prices go up, you have a greater degree of hunger. And because the poor, nearly 70 to 80% of the budget of a poor person goes to food. And that is why when the prices go up, there is more hunger. Then the absorption of food in the body, which is a very important function of safe drinking water, clean drinking water, environmental hygiene, sanitation, primary health care. So that when you talk about nutrition security, both food and non-food factors, like you may not normally think of water as a food, but the fact remains that determines everything. You may have a large amount of calories and so on. We call a child which eats a lot but unfortunately has insanitary conditions and very poor hygiene and also drinking water. It's called a leaky pot. Formerly, diarrhea was a serious killer. After the oral rehydration therapy came, it is not no longer a killer, but the fact remains that water is a very important factor. So we need to look at it totality, the availability of food, which is a function of production, access, which is a function of purchasing power, absorption. And then hunger itself is divided into three parts, chronic or endemic hunger, largely coming from poverty. This is why the UN MDG 1 calls it reduction of poverty and hunger by half. Because although sometimes they are not be related, but the fact remains invariably poverty and hunger are related. Hidden hunger is where you aquaculturists are playing a very important part. Hidden hunger is micronutrient deficiencies, iron, iodine, zinc, vitamin A, vitamin B12. And transient hunger is what you see during civic strife, or extreme natural events, great floods, earthquakes, they will cause a transient hunger. But it can be solved by rushing food and so on. I have given the talk of my talk as a climate, aquaculture and sustainable nutrition security in a warming planet. Although this is not related to aquaculture, but the fact remains, climate, whether it is an aquaculture or normal marine fisheries or inland fisheries, will play a very important role. A very dramatic drop in production recently in Bolivia. Many of you have been reading about it. Enormous amount of cold wave, not a hot wave. 6 million fish, according to the reports, have perished. And thousands of river dolphins, turtles, and alligators also perished with this temperature change. But that shows the importance of a stable temperature. The other major problem is environmental problems of various kinds to fisheries. The recent Gulf of Mexico, we had a similar problem on the coast of Mumbai or Bombay, where two ships collided and there was an enormous amount of leakage. In other words, then, it has become, as we pollute the water, it has become important to have more and more bioremediation research, bioremediation, microorganisms, many of you here know, the very first patent for a living organism was given to Anand Chakrabarty, who is a NRI American, United States, he lives it, for his, by genetic modification, he created a new fusarium which can gobble up oil spills, which can gobble up, that's what you call bioremediation, gobble up oil spills. That was, because the US Supreme Court said, you know, normally they don't give patents for living organisms. This was the first living organism which was given a patent because the court said, acts of God cannot be patented, but acts of man can be patented. If you create a new organism yourself, then you can ask. You have to show it is because of you that you have created it. It didn't exist before and so on. That you can keep in mind, those of you who are wanting to patent new organism. If you take something from the sea, you can't easily patent it. You will have to show that it is something which you have done. Now, the Gulf of Mexico, fortunately, yesterday I read, it has been finally sealed. It was a very great disaster. And also shows adventurism, sometimes adventurism in the name of development, without understanding the full implications of what you are about to do. I think scientists and technologists will have to. I am emphasizing the first part of my talk on ecology because ultimately the sustainability of any issue, the word sustainable fisheries was mentioned earlier by Dr. Konuma. That's all possible only if you have got you can mainstream ecology in agriculture, aquaculture. Either agriculture, aquaculture, kindly mainstream ecological parameters in the development of aquaculture techniques. Otherwise, your victory will be short-lived. You know, I had seen in India a transformation, what was called a sunrise industry, became a sunset industry within a few years, largely because the enormous amount of pollution which was caused, people going to court, the Supreme Court of India, getting it stopped and so on, put a moratorium on aquaculture, coastal aquaculture mainly. So I think it is important for us to become more and more conscious of environmental factors. We know the World Food, World WWF and so on, they prepare these ecological footprints of the world. In the human beings, ecological footprint is the amount of demand you make, an individual makes on natural resources. It is certainly much greater in the industrialized, or even in normal, in all countries, the rich make a great demand on natural resources. Per capita use of water, per capita use of land, per capita use of other mineral and other resources, energy resources. But it is only the poor who finally suffer. The ecological debt is created by the rich people, but the ecological implications usually affect the poor. Take my own country, India, the ecological debt, we have 16% of global population. Probably it is going to increase further because China has practically stabilized its population. In India, there is still the population growth is somewhat high. We have 4% of global biocapacity at the present state of technology. See, the biocapacity can be changed, for example, by technology. Technology can change the biocapacity. If I, for example, before the Green Revolution in India, was producing 1 ton of rice, 1 ton of wheat per hectare, now if I produce 5 to 6 tons, I have increased the biocapacity considerably and so on. But we are increasing amount of ecological footprint. So in the development of aquaculture techniques, again, I want to say that you must mainstream ecological considerations in technology development and transfer and dissemination. Otherwise, the gains will be short-lived. It will have long-term harm. Now, these are some of the slides which are still in preparation. FAO was kind enough to make available. I mentioned that I am giving this talk today. Some data in advance, but you will also see it all in the report. FAO's beautiful report, one of the finest report I've read, which will come out next month. You find the world capture and aquaculture production is going up gradually. China is making a major contribution. In relation to the capture fisheries, the culture fisheries, growth rate is higher. And in the coming years, as you will see, the capture fisheries, by and large, is plateauing. Unless you have new avenues, people have talked about Antarctic krill and so on. There are large areas which are still untapped. But the fact remains that has also its own replication. The Antarctic krill has its own implication. Here you find the aquaculture growth rate is going up. And that is why we must keep it up. We must keep it up because that is where the new opportunities lie, both in terms of technology, world aquaculture production in the region. Latin America and Africa are also making a lot of progress. Of course, Europe and so on have already high degree of production, and therefore it is not, growth rate will look small. Asia is a major contributor to the growth. Trends in world aquaculture production, major species, is all well known to you. I'm not going to take time, whereas aquatic animals are mollusks, crustaceans, marine fishes. Freshwater fishes growth is much higher. In many cases, freshwater fishes, that growth is much higher than the others. There are, the FAO again, this all from, these are all the, these few slides are from the forthcoming FAO publication, which gives the top aquaculture producers in the world today. China is leading. China is number one. It was number one in 1990. It is number one in 2008 over the 32 million tons of aquaculture. India comes next. Vietnam's growth rate is very high. As you see in our, in this region, Vietnam with 16.4% growth rate. And you find among European countries, Norway. Norway has always been a fisheries nation and they have a number of problems. And Chile is another one in Latin America with 19.8%. And Myanmar is a very interesting one. Myanmar's growth rate in terms of aquaculture products is going up at 20. Of course, it's a low base. From the low base, you will always get a higher rate. But nevertheless, the Myanmar progress is a very interesting one because I think the rice fish will help them to overcome their malnutrition very considerably in Myanmar. World aquaculture by production, the freshwater is certainly the highest. The freshwater is highest. The marine is almost half of freshwater. And the brackish water is about one-fourth of the freshwater. In other words, both in brackish water and marine fisheries, as I will come to in a short moment, mariculture, we have enormous amount of untapped opportunities here. Well, the efficiency or income will depend. That's why I put it on. This also of the FAO data. It is very important that the per capita or per family, per fisher family production, of course, is very high in Europe and North America, Oceania also, New Zealand and Australia. But Africa, Asian countries, 2.4 tons per year. Africa is 2. In other words, we must look at production, not only in terms of total production, but also per fisher family production, because that only will give you the income. For example, in India now we have a new national policy for farmers which calls upon the government not only to measure progress in terms of total food production, total production of rice, total production of wheat, but by the increase in the net income per family, farming family. In other words, most of here either must be in the private sector or public sector, most are salaried employees. So you have a salaried employee, but in the case of these people, it's a self-employment. Agriculture, aquaculture, self-employment. Unless you look at their productivity per family, you will not know how much income they are getting. Now, in the case of crops like wheat, rice, a few years ago, as you know, 2008, there was a major crisis. There are so many countries which had food riots and so on, largely because the petroleum product cost went up. Barrel went up nearly $150, $160, and people said it will go up to $200 per barrel. But fortunately, it has come down and stabilized itself. But at that time, as you will see from the graph, whether wheat, rice, corn, and so on, the oil prices, they moved along with oil price because many of the feedstock, petroleum products are the feedstock for fertilizer industry. Therefore, in sympathy with oil price, almost everything goes up, including tractor, diesel price, and so on. But on the other hand, in the case of fisheries, you had a more stable, I wouldn't say it is not going up because the cost of production will always go up along with the inputs. In the year, I'm talking about average, some fishes like basmati rice or a Thai rice, they are always more expensive. But I'm talking about average $992 per ton. 2006, it has come to $1183. But in the case of food grains, it's much faster. In other words, then, you are able to give the fish at a relatively stable price. Always there will be some fluctuations with reference to. One of the great threats to modern fish, apart from climate change, one of the great threats is the biosecurity. As the world is becoming smaller and smaller, enormous amount of transportation, how many planes are flying out? You see our Bangkok airport, one of the world's biggest airport. So many planes, so much of movement now. With the result, biosecurity, quarantine measures, sanitary and phytosanitary measures, these have become exceedingly important. Transboundary, today in my country, the H1N1 strain of avian influenza is creating a lot of problem, including the town I live, the Chennai or Madras. There are the problems of H1N1 strain. There are a number of problems of diseases which come along the biosecurity area. So you must develop a strong national biosecurity system which looks at all aspects of biosecurity, not only with reference to fishes, but also other plants and animals and so on. Public health risks from medicinal, this is another very important point, veterinary medicinal products, there are a number of good examples, recent examples. Biological invasion is a very important one, particularly in the case of plants, number of weeds which come up, alien invasive species. They can take up whole habitats, including, of course, the fish ponds also. The water hyacinth, many of them can completely, whether Salicornia or water hyacinth, many of them can create a lot of problem. Climate change. So I have concluded in this slide saying eternal vigilance is the price of stable aquaculture. Eternal vigilance is the price of stable aquaculture. Now, last year, in December, Copenhagen, and in this December, that will be at Cancun, the World Climate Conference in Mexico. Last year, they could not agree. All the nations participating could not agree and on an agreed legally binding formula. But there was what was called the Copenhagen Accord, which was about 32 countries which got together under the leadership of the President of the United States and agreed upon some broad contours of a climate management, of a world climate management strategy. How are we going to manage the climate together, of all nations together? Essentially, as far as you are concerned, the main point is, number one, recognizes the scientific view that the increase in global temperature should be below 2 degrees centigrade, mean temperature. In other words, temperature rise, this has enormous implications. 1 degree centigrade more in my country, wheat production will come down by 7 million tons. 7 million tons will be the reduction. Therefore, 2 degree centigrade is not a small amount of change. It has implications. I will show you the implications later on. You see, this is also from an FAO publication. Indirect ecological effect of climate change. Change in yield, which will be very important. Change in species distribution, one which is more heat tolerant, will have a higher priority. You know, we just celebrated the bicentenary of Charles Darwin, 150th anniversary of the Origin of Species last year. And what the point he made was the natural selection. Selection will always see that whenever you have got a different climate. Increased viability of catches and seasonality in production. The physical damage is very dangerous. Damaged infrastructure, gear, danger at sea. We had, Phuket was one of those which suffered from tsunami on December 26, 2004. This is the sixth anniversary of tsunami. Large number of lives were lost here. We don't know, coastal storms, many of them may become much more frequent. Sea level rise is another very important. All coastal nations will have to be prepared for sea level rise. And I will talk about in a few minutes. There are a number of indirect socio-economic the migrant refugees, what we call climate refugees, a large number of fisher people will become climate refugees. I see Dr. Lina and I are sitting here. If you go to Kerala, that area, you find people are living almost on the coast. And what will happen to them if the sea is going to go up by 1 meter, 2 meter, they will all become climate refugees. And many of them are fisher families, because they are the ones who are living very near the coast and so on. So influx of migrant refugees. So any country which is preparing an anticipatory action plan to meet disasters must take into account, in the case of coastal communities, whether mariculture or capture fisheries, provision for climate or migrant fishers. The fuel costs will go up and so on, and many of the other implications are there. So one of your very important responsibility at this Congress, because the previous ones were not, we didn't discuss climate, but you are discussing in detail in this Your major responsibility of aquaculture scientists is to come forward with climate-resilient aquaculture management techniques. Climate-resilient aquaculture, it has a number of implications. It may be polyculture, which is very well known from the days of the early Chinese the capture culture fisheries start in China 2,500 years ago. Cultivation of crops from the transition from gathering to food growing started 12,000 years ago. But aquaculture, according to one of the publications, the Fanli in China started it about 2,500 years ago. Integrated water management, integration of fish farming into farming systems, an approach with saline water, because more and more saline water will come, traditional diversification, and above all, ecosystem approach. For example, in India, to give one example, India, the Indian Council of Agricultural Research has divided the country into 128. There are 15 major agroclimatic zones and 128 agroclimatic subzone. In all these 128, you will have to establish research centers which could take into account different probabilities, different weather probabilities. That's what we call ecosystem approach. For ecosystem, each ecosystem, you develop an aquaculture strategy. In other words, in India, our scientists will have to prepare 128 different kinds of aquaculture strategies. The climate-resilient agriculture, I mentioned earlier, breeding is very important. Now today, in aquaculture, after all, induced breeding was the starting point of many changes in aquaculture. Enormous amount of work was done on induced breeding of most of the important species. You have to think of the breeders here will have to work on climate change. Now, one aspect is genetic engineering. Genetic engineering, even yesterday, I think the Bangkok, one of the papers I saw, talked about salmon, genetically engineered salmon. Now, is it acceptable and so on? Well, people, Dr. Kanuma was asking me, will people eat salmon which is genetically engineered? I'll come to it in a moment. But the fact remains, use of genetic engineering to introduce genes for thermo and salinity tolerance and resistant diseased aquatic species needs to be studied in more. In India, we had a large amount of debate, controversy, because a very large number of non-government organizations have expressed their apprehension about the possible dangers arising from genetically modified foods. It is not only in India, but also Europe, for example. In Europe, European community, by and large, have not allowed, although they have allowed a few products, including canola and corn, BT corn, and soya. So I chaired a committee of the Government of India about 6-7 years ago, but I summarized the whole approach to biosafety and regulatory authority, a national regulatory authority which inspires political confidence, public confidence, and professional confidence. The National Biotechnology Regulatory Authority must inspire the confidence of political leaders. It must inspire the confidence of the public, that is consumer. It must inspire the confidence of professionals, that is you scientists. And above all, in today's world, it must inspire the confidence of the media. If the media are not satisfied, they will go to town with all kinds of reports. Therefore, you have to develop a national regulatory authority which satisfy all of them. So the bottom line of our national agricultural biotechnology policy should be the economic well-being of the farm families. Their income should not be affected. It should be improved. Food security of the nation, health security of the consumer, very important, the health security of the consumer, the biosecurity of agriculture, you should not create a new organism or a new disease which is going to create problem, and above all, the security of and international trade in farm commodities. For example, if you create a salmon which is genetically engineered, you don't know, it's a gamble really, how far the consumer will accept it, how many countries will allow it and so on. Thailand, for example, if it puts transgenic rice, their own wonderful rice varieties, it may affect them. We don't allow in India any kind of genetic engineering with basmati rices. Wherever our trade is involved, we ensure, unless the whole world agrees, the whole world comes to an agreement that there is no harm in getting genetically engineered material, you will have a problem. Mariculture, I mentioned earlier, is one of those which a very large amount of untapped opportunities here. It has also risks. For example, I saw the one of the first risks I had. I got a large project drafted on mussel culture. Unfortunately, that year there was a very serious cyclonic storm which damaged all the rafts and so on. We lost a lot of motive infrastructure. So you have the problems which are there, sea bass, muscle farming. Of course, the Spanish are referred to at the top in the muscle farming. The sea bass culture is now increasing in India, particularly in Andhra Pradesh, Kerala, Maharashtra and Tamil Nadu. It is slowly growing, and there have been techniques which have been developed by our scientists for year-round seed production. This is seed and feed and health. These are three very important components. Seed and feed and health care. Of course, finally, marketing. These are the four pillars of the whole commercial seed production exists. More and more self-help groups in Kerala, they call them Kudumba Shri, but different methods of organization. What I want here, the social scientists who are involved in aquaculture, please give some more thought to management revolution. Management as a science, not only aquaculture, but management of the whole production process. How do you give the power and economy of scale to small producers? How do they get the power and economy of scale to small producers? So if we need a small producer management revolution, aquaculture self-help groups, you can have small aquaculture companies, aquaculture cooperatives. We are now India the largest producer of milk in the world, produced by nearly 75 million women, largely because of cooperative societies, organization which has helped the poor to have the power and economy of scale. And so you may have a cooperative, you may have a collective, you may have a self-help group, or you may have a small company, a producer's company of a number of people gone together. But ultimately, if your aim is to introduce a social dimension to aquaculture, social equity dimension and gender equity dimension particularly, then it is important to give attention to the management issues, not only technological aspect. Itkuttanad in Kerala is one of those areas like Holland. Holland, of course, is a classic example of below sea level farming because they put those beautiful dikes and so on over a period of time. In India, over 150 years ago, the farmers of this area got together and said, we should raise a crop of rice during the season when there is no sea water coming in, when there's a heavy rainfall. With fresh water, let us take. So they also put some dikes, but increasingly now it has become a rice-fish rotation. A rice-fish rotation, rice during the monsoon season or when there is fresh water, and fish during the other season with brackish water fish farming. This has, those who have practiced it has enormously improved their income, stability of income, not only the income. So we are now produced, I chaired a committee to redesign this Kuttanad ecosystem. There, Government of India has provided a large amount of funds where we hope will completely change that whole practices there into double production. Now, low external input sustainable aquaculture. Many of you have heard about LISA, means low external input sustainable agriculture. The same thing can be done with aquaculture, which is more sustainable, herbivore based, largely on indigenous species. Water quality. Water quality is so important. I always say that the quality of the water will determine the happiness of the fish. If the fish are very happy, you know their own home is water. The water is quality is very good. And it is important to see that water quality. Low external input sustainable aquaculture can be practiced either in freshwater fishes, integrated farming with livestock, which is well known, one of the early systems in China and India, application of biogas slurry with more and more biogas, weed-based system of carp culture, and then farmyard manure and others can be done. Similarly with brackish water, regulated tidal water exchange, what we are mentioned about Kuttanad, and other, and also at selective stocking of different species. There is need for more and more research here, defining site-specific interventions to increase productivity, developing biosecurity protocols, diversification of the species and culture system, and more research focus on polyculture. Organic foods are coming in the market today, more sophisticated, more and more affluent you become. You want to insist on health food, what they call the health foods. Whether they are health foods or not, I do not know. But nevertheless, organic agriculture, organic products, organic fishes and so on are coming into fore. And therefore, wherever there is a market differential, you can get a better price because you will lose a little bit in yield. And therefore, a little higher price can compensate. 30% of area is kept green with mangroves and others, and vermicompost. I will not go because many of you here may be organic fisheries experts. Many parts of China, many parts of India, for a long time, farmers, these are all farmers' own system. It is not developed by scientists. They do practice. I have seen in near Chidambaram, there's a mangrove area, not Pichavaram mangrove area, near the coast. Many farmers, very small farmers, poor farmers, they have a pond because they can harvest water during the coming monsoon, the northeast monsoon. That is when the ponds are harvested. Then they grow banana around it and some poultry and fisheries and so on. It increases their income. Not only increase the income, but stability of income. Because the poorer you are, there is need for multiple livelihood opportunities. If you depend on only one source of income, if that goes away, then you are in difficulty. But we have learnt it also from the former suicides in India, where people depend upon only one organ, BT, cotton, whatever it is. If the crop fails, then they are in serious difficulty. Where there are many, like the desert areas of Rajasthan, the desert area, there are no suicides or anything of that kind, because there are several sources of income. Multiple sources of income are important. And in the case of brackish water, along the Orissa coast, after the super cyclone in Kendrapara, more and more crop, livestock, fish farming systems are coming in, and they have increased enormously. Now, coming to the tsunami and the bioshields, tsunami, two major lessons we learned. One is wherever there are good bioshields, like mangroves or non-mangrove bioshield, you find at least it's like a speed breaker. It won't stop it. It is like a speed breaker. You find the casualty of life is much less. Apart from this, the mangrove is a wonderful source of valuable genes. It's a very veritable mine of valuable genes, not only for salt tolerance. We have in my own center, some of my young colleagues have transferred the genes for salt tolerance from mangroves to rice, to grain legume, pulses and other crops. Once you have a gene, some of you know Monsanto's work, Cryone AC, in the case of BT cotton and so on. Similarly, we can develop genes for salinity tolerance. The dehydrogen gene is now in great demand. It has got a U.S. international patent, U.S. patents. So these plants along the halophytic plants, mangroves and others who grow near the sea, they have double advantage. They provide as a bioshield. Secondly, it also provides genes for saltwater tolerance. And we have also isolated from mangrove a very important gene for iron. In fact, we have a new rice variety with a very high degree of iron and bioavailable iron, bioavailable iron, which has come from the mangrove species. This year, 2010, marks the 80th anniversary of a very famous march organized by Mahatma Gandhi, whom we consider to be the father of India's independence. And what he did was, the then government put a tax on salt manufacture. Gandhiji said that you can't tax salt because seawater is a social resource. Seawater, which occupies 97% of the world's water, he said it's a social resource, government cannot tax it. It is a public property. And therefore he ran the march, it's a very important one. We had a similar march in South India. But the point I'm trying to make, Gandhi's emphasis, seawater is an important social resource for the poor. They can make salt. Now we must try to promote more seawater farming. Seawater farming in preparation for sea level rise and so on. The seawater farming will be agri-aqua farms. Aquaculture plus agriculture. Agriculture by and large is horticulture really, along various kinds of fruit trees and so on. If any of you travel in the Tamil Nadu or anywhere, please do visit our agri-aqua farms. They are very interesting. Combination of aquaculture. I mentioned about the below sea level farming developed by farmers. It is now, FAO is considering it to be declared as an agriculturally important global heritage site. They have a new program called, UNESCO has cultural and natural sites, heritage sites. FAO, I compliment FAO and Dr. Konuma for starting this whole globally important agricultural heritage site. One will be in India, this Kuttanad, because these are developed by farmers long ago, how to manage below sea level farming. This is a site of the harvest of the rice, and then following this will be a fish crop. Now we are developing a national genetic garden of halophytes in preparation for sea level rise, in preparation for more and more saltwater inundation. What is a genetic garden of halophytes? I will request Madam Director General also for Thailand, prepare a genetic garden of halophytes. The genetic garden of halophytes which we are developing has two components, obligatory halophytes, facultative halophytes, because these may all disappear, you see, unless you preserve them. You know, I don't know whether anybody here is in Norway. Norway has done a great service to humankind by developing a gene vault like Noah's Ark at Svalbard. It's called a global gene vault, which will preserve under permafrost condition genes for posterity, genes for our children and grandchildren. We are destroying. Now, the obligatory halophyte, this national genetic garden of halophytes, will have tolerate high concentration of sodium salts. It has three times of tolerate seawater salinity. They even demand sodium chloride. Not only they thrive on it, and therefore it is very important. In our own calculation, we have to conserve. We calculated how much land we need, how to conserve it. We found about 1,500 species are to be conserved. Facultative halophytes. Most of the species tolerate only, since the DDG fisheries here, you have to take the lead in developing this national garden of halophytes. Most of the species tolerate only moderate level of salinity. Mangrove, for example, mangrove can come only in the estuaries of the fresh water, the river water going into the Coringa mangroves and so on. Great mangroves are in estuaries. Then we will revive, number of coral reefs have gone away. We can now revive them, artificial reef. All aquacultures, you can now promote a lot of fisheries by means. These are our near Gulf of Mannar, a lot of coral reefs, and also in Lakshadweep group of islands. The coral reefs have gone. So, you know, you design, I need hardly tell you how to design for each group of fish, what kind of module you require, and lobsters, what kind of modules require. I can tell you, if you come to Mantabam or Gulf of Mannar, these artificial reefs have revived the fisheries in those regions. Revived the fisheries. You can design it, and you can. And these are done by the local people, by the way. What is sustainable is only when they have a sense of ownership. They have a sense of ownership. They must do it. Then, before I end, in the tsunami, since Phuket was we found that there was a large amount of wisdom, traditional wisdom, in terms of management of disasters of this kind, tsunami, cyclonic storms. Andaman Nicobar Island, because it was near the epicenter of tsunami, therefore it was very badly affected. The first day report said, all these people have disappeared. They are all, they must have gone, they must have submerged, because 30, 40 feet high, the seawater came. But then we sent a team there. We developed a program called Post-Tsunami New Andamans. Those of you are interested how to convert a calamity into an opportunity, I can send you a CD-ROM of that report. We developed a detailed report, Post-Tsunami New Andamans, in which the fisheries and aquaculture are very important. These traditional people, I'll tell you some of the things we recorded. Tsunami warning. The Nicobari said, when we asked them, when sea recedes, turn back. He said, suddenly when the sea goes back, you turn back and run away from there. Then Ongis, they say, solid earth becoming liquid, tsunami, swarms of crabs rushing out of burrows, elephants and dogs becoming very restive. So they have a number of indicators by which they say some disaster is coming. So I think we must chronicle all this so that marry modern science with traditional wisdom. Today it is possible using modern information technology. It has become a very important method of rapid transmission of information, not only in terms of production, but also in terms of marketing, in terms of prices, in terms of disasters, diseases, and biosecurity, and so on. Quality literacy, Codex Alimentarius standards, how many people know in the villages? They don't know. And we have to send this information. Today, modern technology involving not only the internet, but the cable TV, and then the FM radio, and above all, the cell phone. Cell phone, I tell you, is revolutionizing artisanal fishermen in India. now along the coast of Tamil Nadu, every fellow who goes before, after tsunami they got afraid. They wanted to go to, suddenly the sea rose and they got afraid. But now they know, we feed them with information on GPS data on wave heights and fish shoals, location of fish shoals. A person like him who used to spend about 10 to 12 hours on the sea now comes back in two hours with enormous amount of fish. So please harness modern technology, modern ICT for the transformation of fisheries, both aquaculture. There's enormous. This is my last slide. I think one of the areas I find much more important is more and more of capacity building of local communities, local fisher communities, both capture fisheries and culture fisheries. In fact, when I started my interest in aquaculture, one of the first things I told Dr. Jingran, I started a program called Krishi Vigyan Kendra. It is learning by doing, not by lecturing. I said, start it in fisheries. We put up a few fisher people, and many of them are very poor. But within 2 days, they master induced breeding, for example, taking out a pituitary glands, making it an injection and so on. If you teach them by learning, by doing, not by lecturing. So we have now put up in a place called Pumpuhar, is a historical place which was affected very badly by tsunami. Large number of people died there. A Fish for All Center. I must thank Merrill Williams and Dr. Gupta. They coined this term Fish for All in the World Fish Center. They asked me to be chair of the steering committee for that Fish for All Center. Fish for All and Forever. I added another one. Fish for All and Forever. In other words, sustainable fisheries, not only Fish for All at one stroke. But this is a very interesting center, end to end, from capture to consumption. The chap who is going out in the sea with that mobile phone, that he brings the fish to the shore, then the woman take it over, and then it is processed hygienically, food safety, and then it goes to the market. It is either culture to consumption or capture to consumption. You look at all links in the chain, or at a one stop, one area, you have training. I believe more and more such training centers are needed because modern science is progressing so fast. Modern science, if I'm going to introduce genetically engineered crops and so on, much of the criticism comes from lack of understanding what it means. There's a fear there. So the lesson for our scientists, whenever biotechnologists tell me that these people don't understand, I say, don't say, you and I are not understanding. They have apprehensions. You have to allay that apprehension. In other words, unless we spend a little more on capacity building and capacity building, content creation, because infrastructure is easy. In fact, recently I was talking to the Indian Council of Agriculture Research, said, increasingly I find there's a fascination with bricks and not so much with brains. Unless you make this transition from bricks to brains, you will not make much progress. Bricks alone won't make progress. Therefore, ladies and gentlemen, here I hope you'll have the transition to brains. Aquaculture is intellectual activity. It has got a multispectral, and it is the future. It is the future in fisheries. We'll have to, wherever we have water, inland ponds, reservoirs, lakes, and also along the coast. I told you 97% of the world's water is a sea water. That is why on December 26, 2010, 6th anniversary of tsunami, we are launching a very large sea water farming, aquaculture and agriculture in Tamil Nadu on that occasion at a place called Vedaranyam, which is another place where the salt march took place in a big way. So thank you for asking me to come here, and I wish you an excellent deliberation and great advance in the next 5 years. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Professor Swaminathan.